This is Rachel Carson. She pointed it out. There's a limit to how much stuff you can dump into the environment. We had Greenpeace in the 70s. We had the Limits to Growth book, which was written about here. The same time that the Limits to Growth book was written, this book, the Steady State Economics, Herman Daly wrote this book. William Catton wrote this book called Overshoot. He was saying we have overshot already. By 1980, we had overshot the carrying capacity of the planet. You should read this book. It's all in there. But this was almost 30 years ago. And here's what they were all saying, basically. And we've heard this today from some of the speakers today. Every biophysical system has a carrying capacity. And you can't cheat it. These are the reindeer on St. Matthew's Island. Maybe some of you know this story. The United States, during the Second World War, dumped 29 reindeer on St. Matthew's Island because they had a Loran station there, and they wanted the reindeer for food for the Army personnel. But the war ended, so they didn't need the reindeer, and they didn't need the island. They left, and they left the reindeer, 29 reindeer. Here's what happened. 29 reindeer became 1,350 reindeer by about 1958. And 6,000 reindeer by 1965, I believe. And here's what we call K in the middle, which is the carrying capacity. We use the term K for carrying capacity. And the reindeer were reducing the carrying capacity, but almost right away. But here's the important thing. They blew past the carrying capacity. Now, they blew past the carrying capacity quite early in the curve. So there were only about 2,000 reindeer on the island when they had reduced the carrying capacity when they blew past it. And they kept going to 6,000, and then they crashed, just like our friends the fruit flies. So now our question is, you know, and the fruit flies, though, they never had a chance because they just had one little tomato, and they didn't have any regular input. Now, on a planet, we have solar input. But the fruit flies, they blew past their carrying capacity, and they crashed. The question is, can we do that to a planet? Well, remember Easter Island. This is an important study. The Rapa Nui on Easter Island. This was a study by Bologna and Flores in Chile. Here's their population curve approximately. Some people believe that the population went much higher than 7 or 8,000, probably to 10 or 12,000, but it's irrelevant to our discussion here because what we're interested in is what did they do to their carrying capacity? Well, here's what they did to their carrying capacity. They did just what the reindeer did. They consumed it. They cut down all the trees to roll these big statues around the island and put them up. This island was covered in trees and forest. They cut the trees down to roll these statues around and put them in place. Now, here's the amazing thing. Well, here's one amazing thing about it. See these, see where they started having an impact on their carrying capacity? Do you see how early that is on their growth curve? It wasn't when they were at 5 or 6 or 7 or 8,000. It was when they were at a few hundred people. They were already digging into the carrying capacity. Now, here's another interesting thing. When they collapsed, when that economy collapsed, they were still building, they were still trying to dig these statues out of the rock. There's several hundred of these statues that were being carved when the last tree was cut down. I won't make the parallel to our society because I assume you can do that yourselves. So let's get back to our story. Okay, so somewhere we have a carrying capacity. We don't know exactly what it is. That's been pointed out today. We don't know exactly what the Earth's carrying capacity is for us, but it's up there somewhere. And I'll explain to you why I choose this level. And we've had this idea that, you know, with our industry, that we can actually increase the carrying capacity. Well, look, carrying capacity is a biophysical phenomenon of the planet. No, we cannot increase carrying capacity. What we can increase is our ability to consume it. We can increase the amount of it that we can consume and destroy and burn up. And what we actually do is, as we do this, as we burn the forests and we burn the rivers and everything else, we're actually reducing the carrying capacity. And sometime between 1990 and now, we have blown past our carrying capacity. According to calculations by Bill Roos at the University of British Columbia, who developed the ecological footprint concept, we're into 30% overshoot already. Humanity is using 30% more stuff Now, I told you we were going to do the realism part first. We'll get to the optimism part second. What we were talking about earlier when we were on our way in here was bring your own optimism. I'm just going to give you the data as I understand it. I'm not trying to be optimistic or pessimistic. I'm trying to be realistic. So bring your own optimism to this. But I do have some ideas, my own ideas, and I stay optimistic too. I try to keep a sense of humor about it too. As my friend Wavy Gravy says, without a sense of humor, it's just not funny anymore. Okay, so 30% overshoot. So when we're here, we want to know about the future. So in order to see the future, we're going to back this graph up. So here we are now. There's our total throughput. That's all the stuff we've ever used, the yellow part of that graph, the area under the curve. Now we've lowered the carrying capacity of the planet and we've blown past it. Now, does anybody think we can keep going there at 3.5% growth? How about 1%? What if we do an unprecedented, we talk about innovation and efficiencies, what if we have an unprecedented innovation over the next 20 years or next 30 years in which we actually reduce our throughput per unit of GDP from 3.5% to 1%. It's never been done before, not even remotely close. Our throughput pretty much tracks our population growth and our GDP. So let's say we do have this massive, innovative, technological renaissance in which we actually create all these efficiencies. Even at 1% growth, we're still going to double, divided into 70, 1 into 70 is 70, we're going to double our throughput in 70 years. Here's what that looks like. You don't even have to do the calculus. You can just look at that, and you can tell as well as I can. That area under the new curve between now and 70 years from now in 2080 is more than twice all the stuff humanity has ever used. We're halfway through the forest. We're 90% through some fish species. We're 95% through the marine mammals. We're halfway through the oil, the easy-to-get oil. We've used up the cheap oil. We've used up all the high net energy oil. We high-graded everything. So when we say we're halfway through the forest in acreage, in hectares, we're halfway through the forest, but we high-graded that forest. And we've high-graded the oil, we've high-graded the natural gas, and we've high-graded the soils and everything else that we've used. And we've driven the carrying capacity down. So if we keep doing this for another 70 years to 2080, we're not going to be 30% into overshoot, we're going to be 300% into overshoot. That's two orders of magnitude, and the order of magnitude higher percentage of overshoot. I call this the Wile E. Coyote moment. When I was little, we used to watch these cartoons. I don't know if you're probably more sophisticated than we were back then, but we love these Wile E. Coyote cartoons. And Wile E. Coyote always ran off the edge of the cliff and then looked around and realized there was nothing under him. And we thought that was so funny. Well, here's the problem, is that all these growth scenarios, so we talk about sustainable growth. Well, sustainable growth is an oxymoron. Now, sustainable development is conceivable if you talk about qualitative development. But growth, we know, in a biophysical system, remember the fruit flies, right? Remember the bacteria in the petri dish, mussels on the seashore, remember the reindeer. In any biophysical system, there's a limit. And that all growth in a biophysical, or as Albert Bartlett says, if you want to learn about growth, Google Albert Bartlett and look at his videos about exponential growth. You'll learn what you need to know about growth. But here's something that Dr. Albert Bartlett says. He's from the University of Colorado near my hometown in Colorado. He says this: all growth after maturity is either obesity or cancer. Is that not true? Yes, it's true. All growth after maturity is either obesity or cancer. And the further we run out on these growth scenarios, believing that we're going to create some groovy innovation that's going to save us, we're only setting ourselves up for a crash. And that's why I'm saying that the economic crash that we're experiencing right now is in fact an environmental crash. We grew up in a forest. That's how we evolved. And we need to take a step back and we need to look at this and look at the miracle of our lives. Look at the miracle of nature. Learn how nature works. And figure it out from there. Now, here's an interesting look at history. This is 700 million years of history, and this is the diversity of the genera. And we use the genera because the species count is much harder to do. This is sort of a modification between Sepkoski and Alroy's graphs. Alroy believes that these early peaks are much higher, and that. Even close to the current peak, but we don't know all the genera and species that used to exist, so we're sort of biased towards the future in terms of our knowledge about this, but that's not the point. The point is these crashes. What caused these crashes? Well, interesting thing is that the first two crashes, the first one was caused, or I don't know if it was caused by, we don't know if it was caused by this, but this happened during a time in which the temperatures were increasing. That second crash happened when the temperatures were still quite high compared to today, but they were decreasing. So change in temperature seems to be correlated with these crashes. Interestingly enough, the big crash, the big Permian crash there at about 240 million years ago, the planet was virtually frozen. So the sea level was way, way lower. And many people believe that this crash was essentially caused by this freezing of the poles and the lowering of the sea level. Now, a lot of the things you've heard today about the wet zones, the wetlands, and also when we looked at the pictures of the biodiversity hotspots, where are they? They are on the edge of the water. They're at the intertidal zones, and they're in the tropics. This is where life started. This is where life is most diverse. This is where life normally is most healthy. But when you have a massive change in temperature and you either flood the planet because it gets warm or you drain the oceans because it freezes, when you have a massive change in temperature, you change the intertidal zones. Now, right now, right as we speak, the scientists are meeting in Copenhagen. The global climate scientists are freaked out because all of the changes, and you've seen the data today, all of the changes are happening faster than we ever imagined and that they ever imagined. And they're now talking about 2 to 4 meters sea rise is almost guaranteed, and they're talking about 6 or 7 meters. Now, what's 4 meters? If you look up on the wall here, where as far as the wood paneling goes, that's about 4 meters. That much sea rise is going to wipe out virtually every coastal village on the planet. Where I live, in Richmond, the Vancouver airport, are underwater. Bangladesh is underwater. You remember the stories of Atlantis? Just that much sea rise, we'll have 1,000 Atlantises. We'll have 1,000 cities and more underwater. And that's probably going to happen. That's almost certain. And this is why the climate scientists are so freaked out. That might happen in the next 50, 60 years. So these massive diversity crashes in our history are coupled with massive changes in sea level because of changes in temperature. And it's because these intertidal zones are wiped out. And if we have a 4 meter sea rise, it wipes out all the intertidal zones. And then the whole intertidal bioregime has to reestablish itself in a new place. And that can take thousands and millions of years. Now, this is a picture. The last crash we know happened with a meteorite. That'll change your carrying capacity. Now the problem is, and here's another look at it, by the way. This is looking, instead of looking at the genera, this is looking at the families. And you see there's less disruption to the families. The point is, there's a lot of disruption at the species level, quite a bit of disruption at the genera level, and less disruption at the family level. In other words, the basis of the biophysical world is pretty resilient. And we're not going to destroy the planet, and we're not going to destroy life in the planet. That's sort of comforting. It can resist us. I mean, it resisted this. But now we're the meteorite. And the question is, we've gone in a couple of million years, we've gone from Homo erectus there with his spear to this nice couple. But we've initiated this next extinction period. And the question is, how far down can we drive it? And was there some carrying capacity that it was bumping up against there? We don't really know. But what we do know is that, you know, after every crash, it came back. It came roaring back. Life will come roaring back, even after us, no matter what we do. So the issue we face isn't that we're going to destroy the planet or destroy life on the planet. It's that we are destroying our ability to live the life that we've come to know on the planet. So here we are back at our Wile E. Coyote moment. Now, my point is, we have to approach this from the other direction. Rather than little innovations that are going to make us, you know, we often hear the expression, more sustainable. What does more sustainable mean? Well, we sort of know what that means. It means a little bit closer to sustainable. But if you're not sustainable, you're not sustainable. Does more sustainable mean you can cling on a little longer? Is that what that means? We either discover sustainability or we don't. And what we need to do, what we need to focus on is actually recovering this carrying capacity. We need to, when we talk about healing the planet, we're talking about recovering the lost carrying capacity. Now, is that doable? Yeah, that's doable. But it's not about building Priuses. It's going to take much more than that. We need to find a level of consumption below the carrying capacity. There's only one way to get this back on track, is to consume less stuff. Now, this looks dramatic, like, oh my God, like, we're not talking about a drop between 3.5% and 1% of throughput. We're talking about less throughput, less stuff. And we're talking about a dramatically less amount of stuff. So we have to stop using stuff. Now, here's a message no one wants to deliver. I don't want to deliver it. I don't want to be standing here in front of you telling you that we all have to use 50% or 90% less stuff. I don't want to tell my own children that we have to use less stuff, that in their lifetime they're going to have to use half the stuff I've enjoyed in my lifetime. And I can certainly tell you there's not a politician on the planet that wants to deliver this message, and no newspaper or magazine wants to deliver this message because they make a living selling stuff. And every corporation, every company in the world makes money by selling you stuff. So how are we going to do this? And this is why I think it's true. We need a religious paradigm. We need a new vision. We need a new sense of morality. And we need a whole new vision of who we are. That we're not going to sort of baby step our way into this. We're going to have some... We need a dramatic shift. Now, I grew up in a time... I went to high school in a little town in West Texas that was segregated. I went to a white high school. Now imagine that. Whites in one school, blacks in the other. And this was before women's rights as well. And I can tell you, I grew up in a very patriarchal society when young women did not have the opportunities that you have. And those things changed. We changed those things. But we change them by people standing up and making a stand and saying that they will not tolerate the old way anymore. And that's going to take the same thing. That here's where my optimism comes from. And I'm actually a very optimistic person. I have my own children, and I talk to them about this all the time. And I do not hide from them the reality that we're in. And I tell them, you have to be part of a major change in human understanding of who we are. And it's about using less stuff. I'm here with my friend Andrea from Toronto. She unplugged her fridge several years ago. She lives without a fridge. Now, maybe that's just a start, but that's the direction we have to go. Everything I'm wearing, everything I've worn for the last 2 decades is recycled. We do all of our shopping at the secondhand store. We do not buy new stuff. our entire home. We live in a nice home. We have comfortable chairs to sit in. We have a nice dining room table. It's all secondhand. We live off the waste stream of our community.